All right. In this conversation between George Uhle and Walter Langford, and it's being recorded in George's home in Bay Village, Ohio on July 9th, 1982. Let's start off, George, by having you tell me a little about your boyhood around here and your family life, or brothers and sisters, and how you got started in baseball.
Well, of course, I started on the Sandlots in Cleveland, in Class D, when I was about 15 years old. And when I was 16, why, we had a team that was playing for the championship in Class D, the Dubsky Furniture.
Huh. And, real good.
And we went down to one of the final games, and in that game, we got beat 2-0. Excuse me. And the shortstop threw away both runs. Threw a throwing bat to first base.
Yeah.
And that was when one of the big games in Class AA, or whatever they called it at that time in Cleveland, when the Omaha and some of the other teams, when they draw 100,000 people down at Brookside Park at their at those big games. And when our game was over with earlier, we played at Brookside Park, right around the corner from Brookside Stadium, at Brookside Number 2 Diamond, they called it.
True.
Right where, next to where the zoo was, or is today. And we went back over there then to watch that ball game, because we were through early, you know. And we went back over there to watch it. And sat up on under some trees way up on the side of the hill, because they had 100,000 people or more there at the stadium.
Imagine.
And they drew that at the games, those Class A championship games, regular for 2 or 3, 4 years. And anyway, when I was up there on the side of the hill, I never wore any sweater or sweatshirt or anything like that. And as it happened, why, the only one that had a sweater, after I had pitched this 9-inning game right before that, and we're sitting in the shade then afterward, was this shortstop. And he offered me his sweater, and I was so mad at him.
Yeah.
Throwing the game away, that I wouldn't take it, wouldn't accept it from him. And the next morning I woke up and I couldn't bend my arm, and I started crying that I'd never be able to play ball again.
Oh boy.
And as it turned out, the following year in Class C, we moved up the same team and same gang of fellas into Class C, and doggone it, I couldn't pitch either. My elbow was still something wrong with it. And it was a very fortunate thing for me, probably in about the middle of the season, why, there was a carnival on Storer Avenue and 65th Street. And I happened to go there, and they had one of those where you throw one of those nickel rocket balls and at the bottles or something like that to knock them down. And I took the three balls and threw one, two, or maybe the third one, and my elbow, something popped. And after that, it was all right.
How about that?
And then I could go back to pitching again.
Good thing you went to the carnival. Gee,
but that was the funniest experience in my life.
I can believe it.
And but the only trouble was that after that, in early in my career, I had trouble with my elbow from mm-hmm. time to time,
mm-hmm.
and I'd have to go down to Bone Center East, and he'd pop that my elbow or something
yeah.
on my elbow, and he'd pop it and fix it each time.
He was about the first one that knew how to help a pitcher, I think, wasn't he?
Well, yes, he was one of the first ones that.
Now, was he in Youngstown?
Done anything
or?
With any athletes or yeah. anybody that. He said to me that anytime, anybody that makes a living with their arms or legs, he'd be glad to help them, and no matter how busy he is,
he'll pick them right in.
As long as they're making a living.
Now, where was he? Was he in Youngstown?
He was in Youngstown,
yeah,
Ohio, yes.
Yeah. Gee whiz, so you were one of Bone Center's early customers.
Very first, right.
Yeah. Now, did you play in other minor leagues before you got up to Cleveland?
No. I from the Class C, we played in, I played a little semi-pro ball. The next year, I joined a Class A team, and that Class A team, the Stinchcomb Engineers, I didn't like playing for them. After I played a game or two, they couldn't hit or nothing else, and I quit them and joined Jimmy O'Donnell's Bailey Company semi-pro team. And we traveled around the state and played in Maslin, Canton, Toledo, and
mm-hmm.
Cincinnati, and I played semi-pro ball that year. Well, then Glenn Leibhart and a few more of the fellows come back from playing pro ball and were working in town, and the following year the Standard Parts was organized and played in this Class AA, or it was just as much a semi-pro as it was an
yeah.
amateur league,
yeah.
because for land's sake, on our on the team that I was on, the Standard Parts, I got a job working for them, and then they paid me for pitching. They paid $15 or $20 a ball game,
mm-hmm.
and it was a high class organization, the Standard Parts. They had their own truck for us. When we'd drive and go out of town, we'd all ride this truck
yeah.
with the seats in it, and had a lot of fun that way. And while we would go to these different towns, why, we would get paid for the game by the Standard Parts, and we would cut in on the gate receipts
yeah.
and divide them up also, and they
not
like
bad.
And we'd go out of town. Well, anyway, Glenn Leibhart and we had a team that was composed of the Standard Parts team. You talk about a semi-pro or amateur. It had Glenn Leibhart, Heine Berger, and another left-hand pitcher I don't recall. All had been in the big leagues just a short while.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had two Delahanties, Jim and Frank Delahanty,
oh.
playing on our team.
Brothers of Ed?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they had both played in the big leagues.
Yeah.
And Del Young was our manager. He had played for Cincinnati.
Right. Right.
And was played right field on the team.
That's quite a team.
And then we had a fellow by the name of Jimmy Breen, played third base, and he had played in the American Association.
Uh-huh.
And our second baseman, he was from Mansfield, the same as our catcher, and he played just a short while with the St. Louis ball club.
Uh-huh.
And our catcher, Louis Worth, with the Standard Parts, had belonged to the Chicago ball club. He come up with them and didn't stay with them very long, mm-hmm. but it was a pretty well experienced team to play semi-pro ball, I'll tell you.
You know, I think that was common in those days, and when I was a youngster, that the town teams, every little burg had a town team.
That's right.
And they would attract by giving a job in some local store or business to former minor or major league players.
Right.
And built up quite a lineup, really, whereas nowadays I don't think that goes on as much.
No, they're not playing the big league ball players.
No.
Any money to these companies, you know, to work, giving them a job or anything like that. Well, the money that they've been making for the last number of years, they don't
need it.
They don't need it. They don't have to come back and.
But there were two reasons in those old days. They needed the money, but they also loved the game of baseball.
Yes, that's very true.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, Glenn Liebhart then went to the Cleveland Ball Club to. Mr. Bernard, who was
the owner,
president of the Cleveland Ball Club at that time, and recommended me to him.
Very good.
That was in the fall of 1918.
Mm-hmm.
And so they called me over, and I went over to visit with them, and I signed with them. But I made them put in the contract. Because there was so little money in those days, even in the big leagues, that they paid in the big leagues, that I made them put in the contract that they could not send me out to the minor leagues because I could make just as much money playing semi-pro ball and having a job in town.
I'm sure you could.
And I made them put it in there that they would give me my release instead of sending me to a minor league.
Well, they
so,
never...
when we went to spring training, as it turned out, they were going to find out real quick, and they pitched me in the very first series of the season in St. Louis. Second game of the season, I started, and they were going to find out whether I was going to stay with them. Or not.
And you won?
And I won 4-2 and was relieved, I think, in the eighth inning. They put in somebody else, me being just a kid, only 20 years old, why seven innings?
Sure.
Why was they thought it was enough. And I beat them 4-2.
Great.
And they had a good, St. Louis had a good ball club at that time.
Yes, they did.
With George Sisler.
George Sisler, right.
That home run hitter,
Williams, Jacobson, Baby Doll,
Jay Baby Doll,
Ken Williams,
Gideon, and
they
had a pretty good team.
They did,
and
they made a great run for the pennant a few years later. About 23, they were fighting. For the league.
They were right around there.
Yeah.
Then we come back home, and I'll be doggone if they didn't start me as soon as St. Louis came in, which was one of the first teams to come in Cleveland, and I pitched in about the second game against St. Louis again. They wanted to make sure that. If they catch up to me that quick, they'd find it out.
Yeah.
And the game turned out exactly the same way again, 4-2.
How about that?
So
real
then,
good.
Then the following series was against Chicago. I'll never forget it because I went great for I think it was five innings, and. All of a sudden, they started belting me around and really hitting the ball. And I will never forget. And I had Eddie Collins to thank for it. Because Eddie Collins, as he crossed home plate, Leslie Nonemaker was catching
me. Catcher,
and he was balling the dickens, balling hell out of me, about keep that curveball out away from him. And Eddie Collins stopped and turned around and says, "Did you ever stop to think it might be your fault?"
He was tipping it off somehow?
That's what he said to him, that you might have a lot to do with this.
I'll be darned.
And it didn't dawn on me at that time, but before the year was out, and starting the following year, it finally was sinking in that I was tipping my pitches myself. I was throwing my curve overhand a lot higher. Uh-huh. I mean, a lot higher than I was with my fastball.
They'll pick that up pretty fast.
And they, the Chicago Ball Club picked it up right away, and St. Louis didn't.
Yeah.
And the other ball clubs after that I pitched against didn't seem to pick it up because I won 10 ball games.
Yeah, I see that. 10-5 that first season.
That's right. So
with seven complete games.
Seven that year?
That's what it says. So you started 12 and completed seven.
Completed seven. And, and then... And then the following year, at the beginning, I didn't, that's the year we won the pennant, and I did a little more relieving in that. I didn't get no credit now and then or saving or anything like that. And they just used me now and then. And toward the end of the season, Irvin Shocker had been traded over to New York, and Irvin was a Cleveland, lived in Cleveland at one time. I mean, he started out from Cleveland, and I was warming up one day, this is toward the end of the season, and when Irvin was heading over toward the dugout, I called him over while I was warming up, and I said, Shock, ain't I coming more overhand with my curve than I am my fastball, and giving it away? And Shocker says yes, and everybody in the league knows it. So from then on, I started coming overhand just often enough with my fastball then
that they wouldn't
when
know.
I'd have two strikes on the guy, and then I'd throw right down the middle, coming straight overhand like I did with my curve,
right,
and they'd stand and look at it.
Oh,
well, from then on, I got along.
That's right.
Got along real good with it.
Very good. Now,
that was my experience at the start. At the start of my career, and
really interesting.
And starting to go good then, and at the end of the season when we won the pennant, why, Speaker Kumpfertner using me in the last game of the
series
because I was going so good.
Uh-huh.
And had relieved twice, and they didn't hit a ball out the infield in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I noticed that.
And the only thing is, folks, is, well, gee, George, if I start you and you should happen to lose, everybody, the public always says they're trying to extend it to make more money.
So he put Kovaleski back in.
And that used to be the feeling.
Yeah, I know.
You know, they wanted it to go seven games.
And I remember that well.
Instead of getting it over in four or five.
Mm-hmm.
And that year was the year that
after the Black Sox,
the only year of a nine-game World Series, because of the fact that the two ballparks were so small, neither one of them seated 30,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Cleveland only seated 22, and you got 28, 29 in by going all around the outfield and roping it off.
Huh.
And they used to rope it off, even in right field, which you could spit from the second baseman into the people when they roped it off.
Well, that was a memorable series in 1920.
Yes, it was.
All kinds of firsts. Triple play and grand slam home run and everything.
Right.
And Kovaleski's three five hit wins. I was half a century in South Bend, Indiana.
Oh, were you?
So I met Kovaleski a time or two.
Oh, yeah.
As far as I know, he still lives there.
Yeah, he's still living in the same place.
Is that right?
Yeah.
He ran a standard service station for many, many years.
Yeah, and up until up until a year or so ago, he fished every day of his life.
Good gracious.
But now he is,
yeah.
I understand that he doesn't go out anymore. He's mm-hmm. He's getting kind of...
Yeah,
he has to stay home.
He's, how much older is he than you? A little bit, anyway.
Oh, Colby must be around 90.
I think you're right, yeah.
Colby must be around 90 because yeah. Wambi is 80. Bill Wambi is 86.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he's 86.
Yeah.
And Elmer Smith is going to be 90, so
mm-hmm.
I would say that Colby is must
probably
be right 90. Around 90.
Yeah. I don't have my book that would tell me that inside. It's out in the car somewhere.
I got it. I got one right down there.
Don't worry about it right now. We'll get it later, maybe. That was the year in 20, wasn't it, that old Sarge Bagby won 31 games?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he won at least 10, 12 in relief.
Now,
and every time he'd go into relief,
team would start hitting, huh?
The team, they'd score two or three runs off of him, and we'd get four or five right back. That's no kidding.
Yeah, I remember I was a youngster then, about 10 years old. I was 12 in 1920, living down on the Texas border of Mexico near Brownsville. And they had they got the reports by telegraph. There wasn't any radio yet in broadcasting, you know.
And yeah, they used to announce them in front of the newspapers.
Sure, sure. We stood around and watched one game where he beat Brooklyn bad, 13-1 or something. And couldn't believe our eyes when it showed that he'd given up 13 hits and only one run. We said, my God, they had to stumble between every base or something. But anyway, that was one of the unusual events of that series. Let me ask you this. Would the Indians have won that pennant in 20 after Chapman was killed if Joe Sewell hadn't come through? Was he that important to you?
He was very, very important to us.
Yes.
And Joe was a very, very good hitter.
Oh, you know it. Yeah. No, I talked to Joe in Tuscaloosa a week or 10 days ago. And
Joe was a very good hitter.
He of the ones I've talked to, Joe is he's as old as any of them so far that I've talked to. I think he was born the same year you were. And he's the spryest, and he's got more pep and drive, and his voice is strong, and he's enthusiastic and bouncing around and going all over the place. I called him up and I said, can I see you today? Yeah, but I got an appointment in the morning. And I said, what about afternoon? Oh, I got to go out to a nearby town in the afternoon. And I said, well, what about the evening? Now you're talking, he says. So we spent hours talking in his home there in Tuscaloosa on a Saturday evening, and he was really excited about it all.
Well, until I went to the hospital last September,
mm-hmm.
With the bronchial trouble, I had quit smoking right before that.
Yeah.
And I was fine. And when I went to the hospital, I was worse.
I'll be darned.
And ever since then, I walk the length of the room now, and I pop.
Uh-huh.
I can't do nothing.
I'll be darned. How's the doctor explain
I can't understand it. Why?
No.
And I haven't started smoking. Haven't spoken since
then. Good. Well, that's the thing to do.
And but why? I don't know. There's something that they haven't told me. And
sometimes that's true.
That they haven't told me that about.
Was did Sewell become as good a shortstop and everything else all over ball player overall as Ray Chapman had been?
Joe couldn't run like Chappie. Chappie was great at pushing bunts between the first baseman and the pitcher.
That's a knack.
And he was very fast.
Mm-hmm.
Chappie was very fast. Covered a lot of ground. No, Chappie wasn't quite as good a hitter as Joe Sewell, but he could bunt and get on base and run those bases for you.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe never was fast.
No. Was there any feeling that Mays threw at Chapman with that pitch, or did he just get away from him?
I don't know. The only thing is that ball players that were with him and played against him before I ever started, said that he used to challenge hitters and tell them that he was going to knock them down is the only thing I know.
Yeah, he had a reputation for that.
Yeah, and that's the only thing that I know about it. But I at the time, I twisted my knee in Detroit right before we took that trip, and I got water on the knee.
Oh,
so
boy.
I was at home, under the doctor's care, with putting packs on my knee, and staying right in bed until I got over it. Right when this happened. But to me, I have always had a feeling while you telephone, you're going to throw at him, or if he did, why, I don't think he didn't intend to hit anybody.
No.
And it's just one of those things that they tell me that Chappie never moved his head or anything.
He just froze.
It just froze. It might have been in Chappie's head to push the ball.
Uh-huh.
When he turned it loose, and there he stood like this, frozen.
Yep.
Then.
Yep.
That he couldn't move into to push the ball or anything because it was at him. And something like that. Otherwise, I would have thought that he would have ducked and
got
out of the way of the real force of it.
Do you imagine that if he had a modern-day batting helmet, he wouldn't have been hurt much?
Well, I don't know. If you get hit that square,
it's hard not to be hurt.
It's hard to say whether it would have protected him completely or not.
Yeah. Well,
because they say he never moved his head or anything, and didn't give with the ball.
Yes.
So that's what he might have had on mind, is to push the ball, and he was just getting ready to start moving into pushing the ball, and couldn't duck,
Yep.
That's my idea. I might be wrong, but it's
makes
my
sense.
Idea.
Yeah, makes sense. George, what do you think was the best game you ever pitched?
Well,
anyone stand out in your mind?
I had some awful good tough ones.
I'm sure.
Ones that turned out bad. But the games that stand out in my mind as much as anything is two games that Eddie Rummel and I pitched against one another within 3 or 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
In the same season, in Philadelphia, he beat me 2-0, and we got two hits, and they got four hits, and the game lasted 1 hour and 15 minutes, and the next game that Eddie Rummel. They come here on a Sunday, and we come back on a Sunday because there was no games in Pennsylvania that time.
That's
on a
right.
Sunday.
Yeah.
And we played here, and he and I hooked up again, And I don't know whether the record shows it or not, because we had to catch a train to get back up east, and so did they.
Mm-hmm.
So we, whether we started, we started a little early.
Oh, yeah.
In order to catch the train and not miss it, you know, why, we started a little early. Now, how much early we started that day, but it generally was from 5 to 10 minutes to 3 that we would start when they were going to cheat a little bit on,
yeah,
on starting.
Yeah.
Anyway, the game wound up exactly the same way, only I beat him 2-0, and they only got one hit, and that one hit was a line drive right and landed right in front of our right fielder in the first inning.
Hmm.
And I never walked a man, and he didn't. And we didn't get over about three or four hits, and we beat him 2-0. And the game was, we were in the clubhouse before 4 o'clock.
Gee whiz.
Before 4. So whether the game lasted just a little over an hour or not, we don't know, because we started cheated and in starting a little bit early.
Box score, and the official box score ought to show that, though, the time of the game.
I don't, they're very close together, the two of them.
Yeah. Do you remember what season that was?
Well, it would, it could have been, I don't know whether it was 24 or 26.
Mm-hmm.
One of those.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I'll check some box scores. 26 was the year you won 27 games.
Yeah.
And lost 11.
Yeah.
Might have been that year. I'll check, see when Eddie
been,
was.
It could have been in 24 when I won 26 games, too.
No, 23 you won 26.
23?
Yeah, according to this. Uh-huh.
Anyway, it was when they didn't play on Sunday.
Yeah, that's right.
And we used to jump back and forth. Of course, it could have been a little bit earlier in the 20s. I don't recall.
Yeah, in 22, you won 22 games.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll see if I can find those by going through microfilms of newspapers,
yeah,
that I have access to in libraries, you know. And it'd be interesting to pick that pair of games out.
Yeah, to think that we would have one in an hour and 15 minutes, and the next one
maybe
in less than an hour.
Oh,
at least an hour and 5 minutes at the most.
I think the record is somewhere in the mid-50 minutes, like 54 minutes or something for a 9-inning game. Yeah, that's great. What would you say was your biggest thrill in baseball?
Well, one of the biggest thrills was right against the same St. Louis ball club. I don't recall whether it was early in my career when Win Ballou got me out in the 9th inning on a curveball that I just hit on the end of my bat and dribbled down third baseline, and they threw me out. And the game went to the 11th inning, and as I left the bench, I said, I hope he throws me that curveball again.
Mm-hmm.
And when he did, I hit it way up in the wooden bleachers.
In St. Louis or here?
Here in Cleveland.
Here, yeah.
Which is a pretty good drive. It's a good 400 feet.
Let's talk about that a second. I notice here that you really had some great batting seasons, too.
Yeah, well, another real kick I got out of was when I got 5 hits off of Ted Lyon in the 20-inning game that I pitched against him for Detroit.
Oh, jolly. 5 hits. Here one season.
In the 21st inning, I led off with a base hit, and they put a runner in for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how come I pitched that long, but it was always a case that about the, not the next day, but the inning after that, I'd be coming to the bat again.
Yeah,
I says, I'd always say to Bucky, I'll be at bat next inning. So I was always going from a couple innings later to get another chance at bat because I got 5 hits that day. And as it turned out, the runner that went in for me in the 21st inning scored. And I got credit for the game.
All right, you should. But here, one season, you hit for 361.
Yeah.
52 hits and 144 times a bat. That's the highest average, I see. Was you had a 344 and a 343 and 320. And, well, your very last year, you didn't have many at-bats, though. You hit 381. 8 hits and 21 times at bat in 1936. Did you ever play any other position besides pitcher?
No.
No? Always pitched.
Just in the in the minor league, I at the end of my career, and the 1 year that I went over with Steve O'Neill at Toledo just to help out that year, and they give me an automobile to go over at the end of the season. I played a little outfield for Steve then.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had some in those early years on the Indians, you had a teammate who had been a great pitcher and became a pretty good outfielder and hitter, Smokey Joe Wood.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Joe is still living, and he's 90.
I'll be darned.
I got a letter from him.
He's somewhere in the East, isn't he?
A card when I was, yes. Uh-huh. We have his address, and I got a card from him when I was in the hospital.
I'll be darned.
And he says, stay with him.
Yeah, that's right.
That he mentioned that he would be 90 his next birthday.
Oh, boy.
90 or 91.
I've talked to several of your old teammates, you know. In Sun City, I talked to Mel Harder.
Oh, did you? Is that where he's at now?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, Sun City. He moved out there.
Yeah, next to Phoenix.
Yeah.
And in Little Rock, Willis Hudlin.
Willis Hudlin?
Yeah. And in Tuscaloosa with Joe Sewell. Now yourself. And tomorrow I'm supposed to see Luke Sewell in Akron.
Oh. Bill Wamby lives right in Lakewood here, you know.
Well, you know, I didn't contact him before, and I've got, I think, all the ones lined up that I can accommodate, and you can't get too many, or the book gets too long, and then the publishers won't publish it.
Yeah.
Wamby's right here in Lakewood. That's tempting. Real tempting. Anyway, who were the toughest hitters for you to get out and those years?
Well, it's funny. The toughest hitter was he was a pretty good hitter. Was Bob Fothergill. He seemed to guess me right all the time.
Well, that's part of it for
he
sure.
He and Bib Falk was the left-handed hitter that seemed to guess me right.
I tried to get Bib, and he became a teammate of yours over here too for a while. Bib Falk did.
Yeah, yeah.
I wrote to him, and he's living in Austin, Texas. He wrote back and says, no, I won't be able to do it. My health isn't that good. The only person I give interviews to these days is my doctor.
Well, then he must be
kind of
under the weather.
Yeah, that's right. Two or three others had to give me that answer, of course, too. And some of the ones I've seen are not in the best shape. Charlie Grimm is in poor shape.
Is he?
But still very, very much with it. But I saw him a year ago for the first time and talked to him again on this trip just 3 weeks ago. He had lost a lot of weight and is certainly on the way downhill in 8 months' time there. His wife tells me that the doctors think he may have pancreatic cancer.